Thank you all very much, and I hope you had a bite to eat and maybe a drink. Let's start our hearing. We are going to look at requirements 16, 17 and 18, requirement 23, and then we're going to move on to schedule 15. So to recap, we'll look at 16, 17, 18, 23, and then we'll move on to schedule 15.
So I'm leading on requirement 16. I just thought it might help if I set out a bit of background as to where, in particular, the first three points, had, where our thinking had come with regards to that. So firstly, we've noted comments in the relevant representations about visual effects on the substation at Necton. There are residual significant adverse visual effects predicted in the environmental statement. Also, the Secretary of State's scoping opinion stated that dimensions of buildings and site layout should be provided. This is all in the context of, we understand your need for some flexibility, but I'm just trying to set the scene. And also, we found that the future approvals seem to be contained in a number of different places, which we think is going to make it quite complicated for the local authorities in terms of those post-consent approvals. And obviously we'll seek views from the local authorities as well. So our current reading of the situation in the DCO is that requirement 16 sets out dimensions of buildings and compounds, and it also refers to being in accordance with the design and access statement. The design and access statement gives some limited guidance on layout and appearance, words such as compact layout and agricultural style buildings. but it also allows for other infrastructure equipment outside the buildings. And I recognise this is also, you have added a little bit more in your response to relevant reps in terms of saying that appropriate building design and materials will be considered, and the design would ensure blending with the local environment. Then requirement 18 is the means by which colours and materials of the buildings and the hard surfacing materials would be agreed through the approval of the OLEMS. But there's no further guidance on anything to do with colours or materials or finishes. And then requirement 18 is also the means by which aspects of the environments of the substation would be approved, such as the balancing ponds and sustainable drainage and the landscape works. So our feeling is that the approvals are coming in two different requirements, and that there is, although there's, we understand the need for flexibility, and we understand that you're not going to be aware of the, necessarily aware of the dimensions of the equipment that you're going to need eventually. But we do feel that there's possible potential for some more restriction than we've got at present. And I think that was brought home to us 2 days ago when we did a USI and we visited some more of the viewpoints, and we were looking at the visualizations that have been produced, and the blue dotted lines that indicate the Rochdale envelope, just standing in the landscape and looking at where buildings could conceivably be put, although they're not shown in the sort of the visualizations at present, but the potential, then that just made us feel again that there is some need for further discussion on this. So if you'd like to go first, and then I'll give the local authorities an opportunity.
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. Thank you very much for the context. That's very helpful, so thank you very much for that. I've prepared some answers for the specific questions. So if I run through those, and I hope we'll pick up much of what was said by doing so. The first question was, I suppose, a more general question as to whether the requirement contains enough detail on which the future approvals can be based. I think the applicant's position on that is it does, and it's sufficiently clear and precise in doing so. It follows other similar offshore wind requirements, particularly East Anglia 3 and Hornsea Project 2. Obviously, it follows as well the draft DCO for Norfolk Vanguard. So on that basis, we do think there's enough detail in there. I think the way that it has been drafted is to try and include the key design parameters which were used for the environmental statement in requirement 16, so that the key parameters that we used to undertake the assessment in terms of the Rochdale envelope, and then anything else is dealt with in the other requirements, and that's perhaps why it's dealt with in more than one requirement. So the purpose of requirement 16 is to really focus on the parameters contained in the Rochdale envelope. In terms of the second question around detail on the design approach for the buildings and surrounding contained in the design and access statement and whether that should be secured or whether that more detail should be secured, the applicant's position on that is that really the layout and the appearance of the onshore project substation is dictated by the technical requirements, and the design approach is limited by the function that the buildings have to perform. As you mentioned, the design and access statement refers in some respects to agricultural style and gives some indication of what those buildings would look like and what the, and it, I think it gives an indicative layout for the area, but it can't do much more than that until contractors are appointed and the design is worked up accordingly, so that the flexibility is needed there, and there is, I think, only the detail won't come through until that later design process. But as I say, it is very much a functional design and has to be led by the requirements dictated by function and the technology. In relation to the third point, whether the details of the substation required by the OLEMs could be consolidated, I think I've really probably dealt with that already. So the intention was that requirement 16 dealt with those Rochdale parameters, requirement 18 deals more with landscaping and relates more to the OLEMs, and that's the key distinction. And again, it follows the way that the Norfolk Vanguard draft DCO has been prepared. On the question of discrepancies, I don't think we were aware of any discrepancies. The intention was that the requirements refer to up to two buildings for the onshore project substation. That's what's been assessed in the ES, and then the final details will be approved by the local authorities, and that must accord with the design and access statement. So I think we feel that they all work together, but we are happy to look at that in further detail. On the question, now moving to five, of the different ground levels, the onshore project substations, there are two different locations for scenario one and scenario two, hence the different ground levels. There is a typographical error in requirement 1610, which should refer to paragraph 9 and not 8. So thank you, and we will correct that in the next version of the draft DCO. Moving on then to point six, whether the limit should be contained in the requirement to restrict all but the converter halls to a maximum height of 13 metres. As I mentioned previously, what we have done is included in requirement 16 the parameters used in the Rochdale envelope. That wasn't one of the parameters that the Rochdale envelope was based on. It was based on the highest external equipment, which is dealt with at requirement 16.5, and it was also based on the footprint and the height of the converter halls, which is dealt with at requirement 16.5 and 16.6. So the highest external equipment and the footprint and height of the converter halls, that's essentially what form the Rochdale envelope, and that's why those parameters are the ones which are secured in requirement 16, rather than the other assumptions which were used in the environmental statement. In terms of moving on then to link boxes, which is it? Sorry.
Perhaps, I think link boxes we covered, didn't we, earlier, previously?
I think that was jointing those. Do you want me to briefly cover link boxes?
I think there's quite a lot that I'd like to just sort of come back on, and the link boxes are, are slightly separate issues. So I think just going back to the first couple of points, then I think Ms. Fernandez will just make a point in due course about the sort of relationship of, or the sort of dependence on other DCOs. But I would make the point here that a substation isn't necessarily only related to offshore wind farms. So I think it's it would be relevant to look at DCOs elsewhere where there have been substations or large infrastructure such as cable ceiling end compounds. And in some cases, and I can point you to the Hinkley Connector, then there has been a more detailed approach, not in any way limiting the flexibility, but a more detailed approach of the design elements that has then been included and secured in the DCO through a separate requirement. We're driven by the points that I made at the beginning with regards to what we've seen from relevant reps, and so we're just really exploring this. I would make that point in particular with regards to the sort of overall layout. And it was helpful for you to differentiate between 16 and 18, because I probably haven't fully appreciated that myself, so that's very helpful. And just on the discrepancies, there are a couple, but we'll put those into written questions, and they're quite minor. Perhaps now I'd like to turn to the local authorities, really, because the importance is that these requirements will be your responsibility to look at the submissions and to approve or otherwise. And so I think we're just interested to know whether you feel that what is in the current DCO is going to give you sufficient information to then deal with those further approvals, or whether there are areas where you would like to see more information within the DCO.
And if you could just introduce yourself again for the audio, thank you.
John Shaw, Senior Engineer representing Norfolk County Council. Our question actually relates to question number 8, where you talk about the maximum size of the temporary compounds. Now, our concern doesn't relate to the size of the compound, it's more in terms of the duration of use. So, for example, under the Vanguard proposal, the intention was to deliver all of the cables to the jointing pits, and then they would be pulled through. Under this application, what the applicant is saying is they want some ability to use Alton Airfield, which wasn't part of any of the assessment that we've looked at. So as I understand it, they're working on a just-in-time basis. So they order the cable, it arrives just in time, it goes to the jointing pit. However, what happens if for any reason they can't go there? So they've come up with this scenario of, well, we'll go to Alton Airfield, but that isn't something that we've looked at. So as I understand it, the applicants want to use Alton Airfield as a buffer. Nowhere does it explain what that constitutes. What's a buffer? How long is it going to be used for? And the mechanism for controlling that. And that does give us concern. And I think as part of this process, I think you'll probably hear an awful lot of representation from Alton Parish Council in relation to the use of Alton Airfield. So I think it's very important that we get an understanding of what that is. If it's very minor use and infrequent use, that's one thing, it's fine. It probably won't cause us any issue, but we need to understand it and we don't. And the second point that leads into that is requirement 16 contains a list of trenchless crossings. And we understand from the applicant that that's a closed list, but it isn't a list that the County Council has agreed. We do have a concern in relation to the crossing of the B1149. And the reason it's a concern is this, that the all of the abnormal loads for Hornsey 3 are going to have to go across this route, and that's something like 1,200 loads. They're massive. The cable drums are about over 4 metres wide. So there's a lot of traffic going along there. Now, the applicants are saying to us, well, look, we can't do trenchless crossing methods because we don't have enough land within the order limits to actually do trenchless crossing. And our point is, well, you're kind of stuck as well, because in relation to open cut trenching, you've got an issue because you haven't so far demonstrated to us that there's a safe mechanism of working. So to do it, you're going to have to close off half of the road, but you then need a safe area of working. So to do that, it's slightly beyond the white line. So we've seen track runs that show how they propose to do it, but they don't really work. So the applicants have said to us, well, look, we're going to address that during the examination. And if that's fine, if that's what you're going to do, but we're just reserving our position at this time, say it's still an issue and it's still a problem, especially if you're now going to take even more loads to Alton Airfield as a result of the cable logistics area.
Thank you. Would you like to respond to that now, and then we'll return to the substation?
Andrew Hardcastle on behalf of the applicant. If we take the cable logistics area to start, I think view at the Norfolk Vanguard examination was not that the cables would be delivered exclusively direct to joint pits, but the cable logistics area is included within the order limits of that application for the purposes of buffer storage and essentially site offices and welfare for the cable pulling operation during that phase. Now, the same would apply through the Norfolk Boreas application, insofar as under scenario one, during that cable pulling exercise, the cable logistics area would again be utilised as a welfare and office facility for the cable pulling operations. And although cables would be delivered primarily to jointing locations where possible, the cable logistics area does provide a level of buffer storage. Now, I can follow up as part of a written response. Essentially, the numbers of vehicles that we could potentially have utilising that area, which I think would assist the understanding of the number and type and how that could impact. So I think that's the cable logistics area, and we'll continue to engage with Norfolk County Council on that case.
So can I just clarify, the cable logistics area that we're talking about is the one that is shown on the drawings, which is southeast of Alton?
Could we actually bring up a plan so that we can all understand that we're talking about the same thing? So perhaps you could reference the relevant plan and help with that.
Yeah. I mean, that is what we're talking about, yes, but we'll throw the plan up. Yeah. Just while we pull that up, I think I'll just touch on the trenchless crossing of the B1149. As stated by Norfolk County Council, we are in discussions about...
Sorry, can I just pause you? Can you direct us to where the list is of the trenchless crossings?
It's under requirement 16.
Ah, oh, you actually I've got it. Thank you.
Can I just ask to clarify, I'm not sure I heard correctly, did you say that your primary concern was the A149?
No, it's the B1149. Yeah.
Andrew Hardcastle on behalf of the applicant. So on the screen now, we're looking at work plan sheet 18, and to the top left corner of the image there is the cable logistics area. If we could then just scroll down to the next plan. The crossing of the road, the BU1149, is then shown there. If we could just zoom into those two blue dots, that's the crossing that's being referred to here, where Norfolk County Council's preference is for a trenchless crossing. The applicant's position is that we don't feel that a trenchless crossing is necessary in that location. It could introduce additional impacts associated with additional traffic movements to facilitate a trenchless crossing, and we are working with Norfolk County Council to present a workable solution to a trenched crossing method.
Thank you.
I was just going to say, in response, it isn't that you're going to be using the Halton Airfield for the cable logistics area, it's just there's no control over how that's going to happen or how, or what it relates to. That's the concern. As I said, if it's minor use, that's fine. Don't have an issue with that. But it's just to make sure it doesn't escalate, because there's so much happening there, so much with cumulative impact with Hornsey 3. It's just we need a greater clarification on that.
So what I'm hearing is this is a super sensitive site because of the potential combination of effects from different proposed projects. So that we can understand that more clearly, it would be very helpful if you would provide a post-hearing note, a technical note, to explain what is proposed in that area and how that would interact with other projects proposed for that area. Something by form of a more detailed plan, and to address Norfolk County Council's concerns, what specifically would help you to understand this more clearly?
It comes back to the same point. It's just how you can control that to ensure that it doesn't escalate. If it's just low level of use, that's fine. We don't have an issue with it. It's background. If, for example, as I said, Hornsey Project 3 are going to deliver 1,200 cable drums to that site, if that's the same sort of level of use, that comes a problem. And there's nothing to stop that from happening in the way that this is currently written. So I don't have an issue with what it is that you're trying to do, but it's just making sure that's actually what is delivered.
Okay, so a post-hearing technical note would assist the panel in understanding their proposals and the potential overlap with other projects in the vicinity. Thank you.
So reverting to the discussion about the substation site earlier, just to reiterate very quickly, the applicant is saying that in their view there's sufficient within the DCO to control future design elements of that substation, and we have been asking we've been asking questions about whether that is the case. So we'd really value the views from those local authorities who will be in the position that they'll be receiving those approvals, drawings and documents for the substation buildings. Thank you. From Broadland.
Breckland.
Sorry.
John Berry from Breckland. yes, I do fear from being the authority most affected, I think, in terms of the visual impact. I do fear that the point put forward that the design will need to just be based on function and technology, it may not be entirely satisfactory. I think the suggestion about looking at other DCOs as substations is a really helpful one, actually. That is one I would like to pick up with the applicant. I just fear that leaving too many details of what is ultimately a subjective matter, I fear could lead to problems in terms of getting plans approved and conditions discharged in the future. I thank you for your suggestion, and that is one that I would really like to speak to with the applicant post-hearing.
So is that acceptable to the applicant?
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. Absolutely, we're very happy to liaise further with the council and to discuss this, and we'll also have a look at other precedents in terms of design requirements in DCOs.
And I think we would appreciate something at one of the deadlines, but I can appreciate you need a bit of time to have that discussion. So perhaps if I can look at... We'll come back after the coffee break with which deadline would be most appropriate.
Thank you.
I mean, on the general point that my colleague raised about precedent, yes, there may be examples of wording or in other DCOs. That's interesting, but it doesn't mean that because another DCO may have a certain form of wording which the applicant may have put forward, doesn't mean that that's the only way of approaching the issue. So while it may be helpful to point us to examples of where similar wording or identical wording has been provided, that does not necessarily infer that that is the right approach on this particular application. And then the other point, just to
remind you of, the model provisions are rather ancient, and we try not to look to those too much. Time has moved on a long way since those model provisions were coming out, so I would just caution how we refer to precedent, please. Thank you.
And I just had one other point on requirement 16, because it isn't clear who the discharging authorities or authorities are for requirement 16.
Victoria Redmond on behalf of the applicant. I think in the majority of cases it will be Breckland, because they are the local authority within which the onshore project substation and the overhead line works are located, and those are the principal design parameters which are referred to in requirement 16. As was mentioned earlier, there is also a list of the areas where trenchless installation techniques must be used. So it's not an approving local authority, but to the extent that those are in other local authority areas, those local authorities would obviously be keen to ensure that those techniques were used for those crossings.
So could that be clarified in some place in the DCO?
I'm happy to take that away and consider that further.
Thank you.
Victoria Redmond on behalf of the applicant. There were two points which I didn't deal with on that list. I don't know if you'd like me to continue with those. I think that we were now on design parameters for link boxes.
Yeah.
In relation to the link boxes, we have some typical details of what a link box would look like in the project description chapter of the ES in chapter 5. Generally, they will be buried to ground level. If they are above ground level, they will be located close to field boundaries and typically at 5 kilometre intervals. We don't think that they are in particularly sensitive locations, and given that they will generally be buried and that they are small scale, and will be close to field boundaries if not buried, I think our view is that therefore it's not necessary to include any further detail on them.
Thank you.
In relation to the temporary compounds, the question was whether maximum sizes of temporary compounds, mobilisation areas, cable logistics area, etc., should be set out, which are set out in the ES, should be secured in the requirement. We have had a look at this and reviewed this. The cable logistics area, we think, is defined by the works plan. That would go to the full extent of the order limits in the works plan. However, the total area of the compounds could be, we think, secured in the draft development consent order. I think the approach that we have taken is only to secure permanent areas up to now, but we recognise that it may be appropriate to secure temporary areas as well.
We did visit one on, I can't remember which number, but it was in quite close proximity to residential properties. And so it was that one, those, just a sort of analysis really of ones where there is that adjacency to residential areas, then perhaps limiting where the building part on the within the whole mobilisation area took place might be useful.
Thank you. We're happy to look at that.
Necton Parish Council.
Thank you. I refer you back to paragraph 6 of section 6. There is a limit on all buildings except the converter halls. The Parish Council feel there should also be a maximum height for the converter halls as well.
Thank you. The applicant's response on that, please.
Victoria Redmond on behalf of the applicant. There is a requirement, I'll get the right one, so it's 16.5. I'll deal with first 16.1, which says the total number of buildings housing the principal electrical equipment for the onshore project substation comprised in work number 18 must not exceed 2. So there's a maximum of 2 buildings to start with. And then requirement 16.5 says the buildings comprised in work number 8A must not exceed a height of 19 metres above the existing ground level. So the height of the buildings there is secured.
Thank you.
Any further points on this?
Shall we move now to requirement 17?
Comment 17, which is landfall method statement. I appreciate that there you've referenced that in your response to written relevant representation submitted on the 4th of November. But if you could just take us through how you've approached that in the draft DCO for sea defences around cabling at landfall in response to concerns regarding cliff erosion in Haysborough.
Victoria Redman, on behalf of the applicant. We have had discussions with the relevant councils in Natural England, who I think are now all in agreement in relation to coastal erosion matters. The applicant has proposed a long HDD and careful siting to avoid impacts. As a result of the long HDD, works on the beach are avoided. And also we've avoided works on the beach due to stakeholder feedback, and therefore I think the approach is that sea defences are not considered necessary, and certainly they haven't been assessed in the ES.
Could I invite Norfolk County Council just given your relevant rep with regards to this point and whether you're satisfied with the approach now?
Thank you. Yes, this was an issue specifically raised by our local members. We as a county council don't have any statutory responsibility per se for coastal erosion, but there clearly are a lot of local concerns regarding coastal erosion in that area. I appreciate what's been said by the applicant in terms of the further consultation with Natural England regarding works in the area and the use of HDD as a technique, so I think we'd like to consider that a little bit further, but appreciate the efforts that have gone on so far, and presumably we will make further representations if necessary, but we're satisfied that further work has been undertaken.
Thank you.
So just to confirm that point, I think you said that all parties were in agreement. Who are all the parties that were in agreement on this, please?
I had understood that the County Council were in agreement with us, but also North Norfolk District Council and Natural England.
Thank you. North Norfolk District Council, would you be in a position to confirm that, please?
Thank you, Madam. Ms. Delderhod, North Norfolk District Council, we don't have anything to add. Although we did note that in the revised DCO, draft DCO, the reference to Natural England has been broadened out to any statutory nature conservation body. We weren't entirely sure why, but we don't object to that if that's a sensible thing to do.
And to the specific point of my question?
We don't have an objection.
Yes, please.
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant, just to respond to the point about the change in name. That was a request from Natural England, and it was to address that point.
Thank you. So we'll move on to requirement 18. And my feeling is that quite a few of these points can be covered by your written response and written responses from other interested parties. So I propose just to have discussion on 7 and 8, so that's the advanced planting and maintenance operations. But I will ask parties if they wish to make comment on any of the other points, then they may do so. So perhaps if we could just hear from the applicant on advanced planting advanced planting first of all. Thanks.
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. So the question in relation to advanced planting is question 8 on the agenda, and it queried whether subparagraph 2F of the DCO, so we're now in requirement 18 2F. If you scroll up. Requirement 18 2F. Oh, yes, I think that was it. Sorry. Yeah, that's the one. So whether requirement 18 2F should also refer to opportunities for advanced planting, and if so, whether a definition of advanced planting should be provided in Article 2. The applicant's position is that advanced planting is not part of any mitigation on which the conclusions of significance were, or the residual significance were, based in the ES, and therefore it's not a matter which is necessary to secure in the draft DCO. So in short, the answer is no, we do not think it should be secured in the ES because it is not mitigation which is relied on as part of the environmental statement to reduce the significant of effects. Discussions with landowners are continuing, and the applicant is willing to deliver advanced planting if possible, but our position is it's not appropriate to secure it in the DCO.
Have any comments on that, Breckland?
John Berry, Breckland Council. No, I have no reason to disagree with that.
Thank you.
Madam, sorry if I may, Staldahorn, North Norfolk District Council. We have not as yet had an opportunity to speak in detail with our landscape officer on the points that have been raised in this agenda. So we need to reserve our position on the more general idea of advanced planting. So I just wanted to make that plain.
Thank you for that. And there'll be an opportunity because, as Ms. Fernandez said, these points will occur as in the first round questions. So if we move on to the detail about maintenance operations, which is the next one under requirement 18, whether subpara 2H gives enough detail about the maintenance operations.
Yes, Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. So this is dealt with in the OLEMs at paragraph 6.8.3. And we feel that given the level of detail included in the OLEMs, it's not practicable to include it in the draft development consent order itself. I think our view is that where we secure something through a plan, it is not necessary to repeat it in a requirement in the draft DCO.
Any comments from Breckland?
John Berry, Breckland Council. I would agree with that, I think, subject to a suitable condition in terms of securing the plan.
So that would be requirement 18. So if you have concerns with the way that requirement 18 will secure that, then if we could hear about those in response to the first round questions, that would be helpful.
John Berry, Breckland Council. Yes, agreed.
So I don't have any further questions that I was going to raise about requirement 18 here. All those points will be in our first round questions. I'm mindful a lot of them are just, they're questions that can be responded to in writing, and so we'd appreciate obviously a response from the applicant, but from any of the affected local authorities as well. So
let's turn now to requirement 23, which is the archaeological written scheme of investigation, and we'd be interested in your response on the questions that we ask there. Thank you.
Thank you, Victoria Redman, on behalf of the applicant. The first point under requirement 23 was to consider the National Trust's request to be named in connection with the Blickling Estate as a consultee, along with Norfolk County Council and Historic England in requirement 23. The applicant's position is that the outline written scheme of investigation already includes commitments to consult with National Trust, and these are at section 6.8. And therefore, this is already secured by requirement 23. As a general principle, the applicant's view is that the draft DCO should only refer to discharging authorities and statutory consultees on the face of the DCO, and that if anyone else requires consultation, if we consider it appropriate to do so, we would include that in the outline plan.
So I think you said in your response to relevant reps that all matters had been resolved with the National Trust. So has that matter been resolved with the National Trust?
Victoria Redman, on behalf of the applicant, I don't want to speak on behalf of the National Trust. I had thought it had been resolved. In respect of the Norfolk Vanguard application, the National Trust has withdrawn its objection to that scheme, and the documents that we have submitted for Norfolk Boreas follow the same approach as Norfolk Vanguard. The National Trust has not yet withdrawn its objection for Norfolk Boreas, but I believe that all matters have been agreed on the basis that it was agreed for Norfolk Vanguard.
Okay, well, we'll await some documentation to show that.
I mean, it would be probably a good idea if you were talking to National Trust to suggest that they might want to withdraw their objection if all things have been agreed.
So are there any views from Norfolk County Council on this point?
Laura Waters, Norfolk County Council. No, we don't have any strong views on this point.
And does Historic England want to make any points?
Christopher Pater on behalf of Historic England. No, we've got no further comments to offer on that one.
Thank you. So the second point was with regard to the sort of overlapping of archaeological investigations.
Yes, Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. In relation to that matter, we don't think it's necessary to include or make any amendments to the draft DCO. Protective provisions are included to govern the interaction with Hornsey Project 3. The applicant is also progressing a cooperation agreement with Hornsey Project 3, which relates to matters such as sharing of survey data, liaison on programming and engineering methods at the crossing point. Therefore, it's not considered necessary to include any reference to them in the DCO or to refer to them as a consultee.
And I think you said in your response to relevant reps that that will be commercially sensitive and not put before this examination.
Yes, that's correct.
So I don't know whether it would be possible to have some kind of indication of the sort of items it's going to cover rather than the full document. So heads of terms and the area, the sort of activities that it will cover would be helpful.
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant, we'll liaise with Hornsey Project 3 and see if we can come to some agreement about the information that we can put into the examination.
Thank you very much.
I wonder if I could just deviate slightly. You referred to protective provisions with Hornsey Project 3. Who would those protective provisions be drawn up with?
We have included protective provisions for Hornsey 3's benefit in the order, sorry, in the draft development consent order, and they have been agreed with Hornsey Project 3, so the applicant for Hornsey Project 3.
And in the scenario, looking into the future, where perhaps the benefit of the order is transferred to another party, what would happen to those protective provisions?
I'm happy to respond on this in writing. I haven't looked at this point specifically. I think that they would still apply because I think it's for the benefit of the undertaker with that equipment rather than Hornsey Project 3 in their own capacity. So I think it's that the benefit is given to the cables that they install rather than to them. But I can check the protective provisions are worded in that way and come back to you.
And I think it's a wider question also in relation to Norfolk Vanguard. If one let's assume Norfolk Vanguard is consented, and let's assume the benefit of the order was transferred to A and Other out with Vattenfall, again, what would happen in the scenario of that being a different undertaker? Some thoughts on that would be helpful.
Yes, we're happy to do that.
The items 3 and 4, we suggest we defer that discussion until we get to discharge of requirements later on in Schedule 16.
Right, well, according to my notes, we're now moving on to Schedule 15 arbitration rules. If anybody thinks differently, please tell me. Yes, North Norfolk District Council.
Madam, thank you. Estelle de Hon on behalf of North Norfolk District Council. Just to flag that in writing, we'll be suggesting an additional requirement, which is to do with tourism impact. We'll provide drafting an explanation for why we think that requirement is both necessary and a proper requirement.
Thank you. Then if I could ask us all to turn to Schedule 15, please, in the draft development consent order. So this is often a schedule where there is quite a bit of discussion in terms of board applications for development consent. I think what would help us through this, please, would be if you would just talk us through what is in the schedule. And then I will invite MMO to share their concerns, if there are still any, and then the local authorities. So perhaps if we go that way around, please.
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. So Schedule 15 relates to Article 38 of the draft DCO and essentially sets out the rules of how any arbitration required under the DCO would be dealt with. Paragraph 1 sets out the primary objective of the arbitration. Paragraph 2 sets out the time periods for the arbitration on how they will be calculated. And then paragraph 3 details the timetable for the arbitration, sets out the process by when the arbitrator will be appointed, how a written statement of claim will be prepared, what it should include, and also the proposals for responding to that in terms of the written statement of defence. And then turning over the page, the timetable continues there. And then paragraph 4 deals with the procedure for the arbitration, again setting out the detail of how witness statements and expert reports should be prepared, for example. Also deals with late submissions, notifications of hearings, how a hearing is to be held, whether expert evidence should be submitted, and then the process for examination of experts. Then turning over to paragraph 5, it sets out the arbitrator's powers and refers to the powers set out in the Arbitration Act 1996. Also deals with discovery and disclosure and time limits. Paragraph 6 deals with costs of the arbitration and how those will be met. And paragraph 7 deals with confidentiality and notes that the hearings are to take place in private.
And obviously we discussed the relating article before lunch, and MMO and your joint position statement was given an airing. I don't expect MMO to say anything further unless there is anything you want to say in addition to what you were discussing this morning.
Rebecca Reed, the MMO, no, nothing further.
And just really looking across to all the local authorities, is there any comments that you want to raise in relation to the detail of this schedule?
Thank you, Madam. Estelle de Haan, Norfolk District Council. As we understand it, we don't fall within the schedule at all, because Schedule 16 is the schedule that applies to us in relation to the discharge of requirements and any appeal process that might follow.
I'm assuming that would be the same for the other local authorities. Thank you. Okay. Then let us turn now to the next schedule in the draft development consent order. And again, if you would be so kind as to take us through it briefly, and then I will ask local authorities whether they have any concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Victoria Redman, on behalf of the applicant. Yes, Schedule 16 sets out the procedure for discharge of requirements. It sets out which requirements it relates to. It sets out the right of the discharging authority to request further information at paragraph 2, and it sets out an appeal process at paragraph 3 in the event that the discharging authority refuses an application, does not give notice of a decision for an application, or the undertaker considers that the further information requested is not reasonably necessary to consider the application, or following the receipt of that further information, the discharging authority notifies the undertaker that the information is inadequate. And then following that is the appeal process to be followed in the event that an appeal is undertaken.
Are the local authorities content with the drafting of this schedule?
Thank you, Madam. Estelle de Haan, North Norfolk District Council. We are. This schedule is based substantially on a schedule that we worked on in detail with the applicant in relation to Vanguard, and barring just double-checking the cross-reference to the various requirements, everything else is as previously agreed, and we think is a sensible and workable approach for this scheme as well as for the other scheme.
Thank you very much, that's very helpful. And just working around the table, please.
Steve Horton, the Norfolk County Council, totally reiterate what Norfolk District Council has said.
Thank you.
The Highway Authority is a statutory council team, Adam. We wouldn't be the ones discharging.
Okay, and Breckland and Broadland.
John Barry, Breckland Council, agree with North Norfolk's position.
Yep, echo what's already been said, thank you.
Thank you very much.
There's just a small point which I think can be clarified post-hearing fairly straightforwardly. The intertidal zone, and you did preempt in your earlier answer that there's unlikely to be any impact in the intertidal and under the current proposals. However, we have noticed that in the DMLs, there is a reference to the written scheme of investigation for archaeology offshore extending to the low water line, whereas all of the other offshore matters, of course, are to the high water line. Is there a gap, broadly speaking? The onshore WSI will be to the high water line. The offshore, at the moment, is to the low water line, so the intertidal is missing.
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. Our position on that is that there won't be any impact in that area because of the long HDD, and therefore it's not necessary to cover the intertidal area.
Mm. So it's a deliberate exclusion?
That's correct.
Okay. I think we should just check. I'm not sure whether it's something Historic England would have a view on, but perhaps you'd like to comment.
Christopher Bater on behalf of Historic England. It has been made clear in the course of the hearing today regarding the use of horizontal directional drilling, HDD, that would go under the foreshore, presumably,
yeah.
And that looking at what was already used in terms of the provisions for the offshore archaeological written scheme investigation and here, in terms of consultation, it did seem clear to us that there was involvement between ourselves, the relevant local authority, but also in terms of formal referral for approval to the Marine Management Organisation. So those mechanisms still were in place, should it be the case that some degree of foreshore works were required. And we would, of course, expect it to cover the entire extent for which marine licensing is applicable. That would be up to Mean High Water Springs. Thank you. That's all for now.
Thank you. MMO, any further comment about your level of comfort with this?
Rebecca Breed, the MMO. From my understanding, we are happy with this, but I will double check and put if we've got any concerns in the written rep.
Thank you. It's just worth mentioning. The foreshore is owned by North Norfolk District Council. Any comments from you?
Yes, thank you, sir. Estelle Dehon, North Norfolk District Council. When we flagged there was an issue we wanted to chat about with the applicant, this is it. District Council.
Very good. Norfolk County Council obviously have archaeological responsibility, if I understand it, to the Mean High Water Line. Entirely comfortable with anything beyond beyond the mean high water or below the mean high water line being within MMO and Historic England's jurisdiction?
Steve Horton, Norfolk County Council, yes, we would be perfectly happy with that.
Thank you.
In which case, we're moving over to Schedules 9 to 13, the deemed marine licences. The first question we aren't proposing to raise today in relation to Natural England. We'll come back to that tomorrow. So really I think it's a question for the MMO primarily as to whether there are specific points that you wish to raise at this point in relation to the drafting of the DCO that were not addressed in the applicant's response to relevant reps on the 4th of November, and also Historic England, if there's any points you wish to raise in relation to the drafting of the DMLs.
I don't want to preempt anything you might want to say. Would you, have you? Just a particular point, MMO has raised a number of concerns about concurrent piling, and the effects of potential concurrent piling between adjacent developments. It seemed to me that the Condition 21 aspect here, which is the request, for, if I understand it correctly, that there should be a limitation on a single pile being installed within a 24-hour period. Is this something that you're yet happy with in the response to the relevant representation, or do you want to take this further in written representation after the hearing?
Rebecca Reed, the MMO. We have taken the comments into account from the applicant, and we do generally look for opportunities to condition reduction in noise, but we want to discuss further with our noise specialists on whether it can be acceptably considered through the SIP. So we're happy to work with the applicant from this.
Thank you. The rest of the room had appeals.
Historic
process.
England.
Thank you. Christopher Pater on behalf of Historic England. You asked in terms of the present wording for the provisions within the DMLs for the two generation assets and the two transmission assets. I'll also add that into that also the interconnector DML,
yes,
as well.
Yeah.
That we did notice that there was provision made in there for a post-consent preparation of an archaeological written scheme of investigation for the offshore area as informed by or directed by the outline archaeological written scheme investigation, which is prepared as part of the initial application. I noticed in reference to the particular question that was made here in terms of part four of under requirement 23 about all the mitigation measures required in the outline archaeological written scheme investigation. And what I would sort of qualify there, and I can include in response to written questions, would be that the WSI will include a lot of detail in terms of the techniques and methodologies to be employed. The crucial thing about the wording within the DML is a time mechanism for its realisation to inform the actual delivery of a project should consent be obtained. And we are satisfied by the present wording in the draft DCO and DMLs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just checking.
Anything further from MMO or Historic England? I think there's things for you to be coming back on, is what I'm picking up here.
Rebecca Reed, the MMO. I think we're satisfied with the discussions that are happening with the applicant now.
The applicant, would you like to say anything? Not particularly looking for a response, unless there's anything you wanted to add into the conversation.
Victoria Redmond on behalf of the applicant. We're happy to respond to the particular questions in writing.
In which case, let's turn to the last item on the agenda today, which is item 6, consents, licences and other agreements. A few points here. I wonder if Norfolk County Council might lead us into the discussion in relation to the first item, please.
Stephen Faulkner, Norfolk County Council. The County Council, in making a response to this proposal, is broadly supportive of the offshore wind sector as a matter of principle, subject to a number of caveats, one of which clearly is as Highway Authority, and my colleague John Shaw has raised a number of issues on that point. But while the County Council does support the wider benefits, both as a renewable energy scheme, as well as the sort of economic benefits, there's also an issue which particularly an issue for local communities affected by the schemes and the ability of the scheme to provide some wider community benefit. Now, we appreciate that this may lie outside the DCO process, but I think it needs to be flagged up at this early stage just to make the panel aware that there will clearly be communities with across Norfolk as a whole who will be affected by the construction, particularly the pipeline, cable route line, landfall, grid connection, etc. So it's felt that there should be some sort of mechanism and regard made throughout the process to the potential for community, the wider community benefits which could arise. So it's just putting in that sort of context. We are satisfied as an authority and been working very closely with the applicant in terms of economic and employment strategy, and that's down as a requirement. I think it's requirement 33, and that's something we worked with Vattenfall on the Norfolk Vanguard scheme and continue to work with Vattenfall on the Norfolk Boreas scheme. So that side of it we're very comfortable with and very supportive of, but it's this wider issue of the wider community benefits which we'd like to just raise with the panel this afternoon. Thank you.
And what is it that Norfolk County Council is looking for?
Steve Horton, Norfolk County Council. I think the sort of thing we're potentially looking for is some sort of potential for, whether it's a trust fund or a fund where local communities can bid into. We know this has been done with other schemes around the country where there have been offshore renewable energy projects which have made landfall and affected local communities. So it's just the potential for those communities to bid into that fund and to be able to make some sort of connection with it and get some local benefit. The sort of things we're probably thinking about, particularly Necton community, which is going to be disproportionately affected in Norfolk as a whole, and whether there's potential there to get any sort of benefits. There's also things like the Windmill Trust, which the County Council is very much engaged with, the Norfolk Windmill Trust, and whether there's any synergy there between the offshore businesses, both Vattenfall and Ørsted and others, and whether we can bid into any sort of funds for that. So it's that sort of thing we're looking at for the future.
Thank you very much. Yes, to Breckland.
Yeah. John Berry, Breckland Council. I would just like to put it on record and make it clear from Breckland Council's point of view that we would entirely support those comments put forward by the County Council.
Thank you. The applicant.
Thank you, Victoria Redden, on behalf of the applicant. I don't have a great deal to add. I think we are agreed as parties that a community benefit is something which is dealt with outside of the DCO process and therefore not a matter to be explored in any great sense in this examination. And as was said, we've worked hard on the skills and employment strategy, which is secured through requirement 33 of the draft DCO. I wonder if it might help if I pass over to a colleague who can explain what is being done in relation to community benefits more widely.
In what context would that enable us to understand this better?
It is just giving you an understanding of how what the applicant is doing outside of the DCO process to address the concerns which have been raised by those other parties.
Is this anything that's secured by the form of a legal agreement or anything else, or is it measures that would be undertaken in form of goodwill?
They are entirely voluntary measures.
Then I think probably thank you for the offer, but at this stage we don't need to go any further on this point. Thank you. But of course that's not to stop conversations happening outside the room. And North Norfolk District Council.
Madam, thank you. Estelle de Hon, North Norfolk District Council. We don't have anything to say on the discussions going on outside of the DCO process, other than being supportive of that. We just wanted to flag that that is very different from what we're going to be submitting in relation to the tourism-based requirement, which we're going to be drafting, and we'll explain why that needs to be within the DCO process rather than outside.
Certainly, and the reason I just paused there is that as an examining authority, we will take into account things that are secured in the DCO, but we have to be careful about how much weight we give to other things that may not be part of the application and secured through the development consent order, which is why I've just paused there. Thank you. Let's turn now to item two, number two, Roman numeral two of item six. We were looking at Cadent Gas, National Grid and Environment Agency. I think there are other protective provisions. So a quick summation of how the dialogue is going would be very helpful.
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. Yes, I think we provided an update on landowner negotiations and negotiations with statutory undertakers in our response to the Rule 6 letter. Generally, we are liaising with statutory undertakers, including Anglian Water, National Grid, Cadent Gas, UK Power Networks, Network Rail and the Environment Agency. Anglian Water, Norfolk Vanguard Limited and Orsted Hornsey Project 3 have indicated their content to use the protective provisions as currently drafted and included in Schedule 17 of the draft DCO. It is anticipated that protective provisions for the other statutory undertakers will be agreed in a similar, if not identical, form to those agreed for Norfolk Vanguard. Matters were agreed with National Grid and Cadent Gas for and the Environment Agency for Norfolk Vanguard. I think there's no reason to think that that will be any different, certainly for Cadent Gas and National Grid. We have been in discussions with the Environment Agency and they have told us that they have updated their protective provisions or would like some updates to the protective provisions that we have used. We have sought to engage on that and we are waiting to hear from them in respect of those updates, but we are looking to engage with them on that.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I just wasn't listening well enough. Network Rail, where are you with
that? So the same can be said for Network Rail. So for Network Rail, we agreed protective provisions for Norfolk Vanguard, and we would expect those to follow the same vein for Norfolk Boreas, and we've no reason to believe that we can't progress those and conclude those during the examination period.
Okay, thank you. And wanted us just to consider this little point from the Coal Authority. What's your response in relation to that, please?
Yes, on that one, we thought that the best way of dealing with this might be to put something in the outline code of construction practice to effectively include their informative within that document, because that would be the document that the contractors would be using and so would be most likely to see and be aware of. So essentially a notice or an informative in that document in the form that they've requested.
And are you in dialogue directly with the Coal Authority, and have we any understanding of whether that would be something they would support?
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant. No, we haven't spoken to the Coal Authority. We don't know whether they would support that. When I saw the response, I assumed it was essentially a more equivalent to a standard response that you would see for a planning application, where informatives are routinely attached to planning permissions rather than a DCO application. But we haven't checked whether they would be content with that approach.
I mean, certainly it might assist us if we can include a first written question to them, but I think it would just help, I think, for you to talk.
Victoria Redman on behalf of the applicant, we're very happy to, if we can find the right contact, to liaise with them and to ask the question, see whether they're agreeable to that proposal.
So as I don't think we're going to be breaking for a tea break, we're going to go back to a deadline for the discussions that Breckland and the applicant are going to have over design approaches for the substation area. So my feeling is that if something could be presented at deadline two, which is Tuesday the 10th of December, and that will give other authorities and IP as an opportunity to respond at deadline 3.
Victoria Redmond, on behalf of the applicant, will certainly try our best to put something together in that timescale.
John Berry, Breckland Council. I agree. Yes, we'll aim for that.
Thank you very much.
So we're coming towards the end of our agenda that we wish to discuss with you today. Are there any other matters that parties would like to raise? And just while you're thinking about that, there is something that was in the rule, in your response to our Rule 6 letter in relation to compulsory acquisition, and you were asking whether we might be satisfied with the same approach to the schedule that you had used on Norfolk Vanguard, and I'm afraid we're not, and I will be including a first written question to ask for a more fuller schedule with all the plots specified and so forth. But I thought I'd just let you know in advance.
Victoria Redmond, on behalf of the applicant, thank you for the advance warning, and that's not a problem at all.
In which case, if I can start from the right-hand side of the room and just ask about any other matters you'd wish to raise today. And that's Broadland.
Matthew Rook, Broadland. No further matters, no.
Thank you. And Breckland?
John Berry, Breckland Council. No further matters either.
And the County Council?
Martin Dixon, Norfolk County Council. Just very briefly, we return to Article 35 in the draft DCO, and it's regarding the lopping of trees and cutting of roots on the corridor. And I would refer you to the National Joint Utilities Group, NJUG for short. I think it's called Briefing Note 4, which gives guidelines, and we use it for when utilities work in the vicinity of trees, give guidelines towards the cutting of roots and long-term damage to trees. I think you need to make some reference to that, or at least see what the guidelines are. I'm thinking particularly of roadside trees where you perhaps cross the public highway. The vast majority of them are landowner maintained because they're on the highway boundary. There are a few cases in the county where they are highway trees. So I'd say refer to NJUG Guidance Note 4, please. Okay.
So if we can put that as an action for you to come back on. Thank you.
Anything else from the County Council, please?
Laura Waters, Norfolk County Council, no further issues.
And North Norfolk District Council.
Estelle de Hon, North Norfolk District Council, nothing further, thank you.
MMO?
Rebecca Reed, the MMO, no, nothing further, thank you.
And Historic England?
Christopher Pater, Historic England, no further matters from us.
And Necton Parish Council?
Alice Payne, Necton Council, there are a number of things we want to raise, but we will raise them in this evening's session.
Okay, many thanks for that. And the applicant, is anything further from yourself?
John Horton for the applicant, nothing further from us, thank you.
In which case, thank you all for attending today, and I will close the issue-specific hearing into the development consent order to a close at 15:08. Thank you very much.